be such a dominant aspect of my public life. As to my practice of the law, it was characterized primarily by my work in the courts. I early became, because I'd had such an extensive clerkship in the law, rather well-versed in the practice and in the trial of cases. And in this period of my active practice, 1927 to 1941, that 14 years, I concentrated on the trial of cases. It was really the liquidation time of the Great Depression of 1929-32, and there was a great deal of litigation by way of the liability for breaches of fiduciary relation, which the banking world and the brokerage world had toward many of the corporations in which the people invested enormous sums. And a great many of these scandals were unearthed, and some redress was obtained through the activities of what the Wall Street legal fraternity liked to describe as strike suitors, which would have included Javits and Javits, but which really was simply a public interest law as practiced at that time, and a very necessary process to recover ill-gotten gains and to endeavor to purify the securities business, which ultimately culminated in the Securities and Exchange Commission and the reforms of the New Deal. I spent that 14 years very largely in the courts of the state of New York, the Supreme Court, the federal courts, and the courts of other states, notably Delaware, where many of these enterprises had been incorporated. And a sampling of a few of these cases will be an indication of my practice of the law. For one, representing security holders of Kroger and Toll in the early 30s, my law firm, with me as the operating court member, brought about the bankruptcy of Kroger and Toll in this country so that a trustee could be appointed to look into its affairs. And in that connection, my firm hired one of the most famous lawyers of all time, Samuel Unamire, to be the attorney for the petitioners in bankruptcy. And I sat at Mr. Unamire's side while he tried this case before a referee in bankruptcy. And I joined in the, and I did a lot of the legwork, which unearthed assets of Kroger and Toll, and this was the greatest scandal of its day, in the United States. This was a very critical a part of my early training as of expertise in the trial of cases, and also of the reputation for being competent and aggressive in the practice of law, and for working effectively to get results. Indeed, it was my brother, who was the head of the firm and the principal business getter and financial man of the firm, was able to show a great measure of of success in his efforts because our firm was never shrank from joining issue in court. This was an extremely effective means for getting results in the law, rather than the other course of trying to settle cases in order to avoid a court contest. Paragraph, another case of considerable importance which I handled was the firm's representation of the preferred stockholders of the Standard Gas and Electric Company, one of the great utility companies of the country, which had been put together by a Chicago banking house named H.L. Billsby and Company, B-Y-L-L-E-S-B-Y. Stockholders' actions, which were then taken, and the ultimate reorganization of the country in the federal district courts of Delaware, which ensued, and the recoveries effected, resulted in enormous reestablishment of the values of the securities of the company. Insofar as the class of stockholders which we represented, to wit, the preferred stockholders, were concerned. Another case of comparable magnitude which engaged me in that whole interval was the General Investment Company, a company which had been organized by Kidder Peabody and Company, the Chase National Bank at that time, and other banking interests. And where, again, as a result of a stockholder's action, where the company had lost practically everything, had practically no assets at all, when it was taken over, that is, control was taken over by a group of Boston young financiers named Smith and Henderson. At that point, my firm was already suing on behalf of stockholders to recover from the banks and brokerage firms who allegedly eluded the company through improvident actions. It was the last case I tried before going into the Army. In November of 1941, it resulted in a $3.5 million recovery for the benefit of the company, which by that time had taken over the lawsuit, with us continuing as lawyers, and the avails which resulted formed the basis for the company and the Messrs. Smith and Henderson going out early and during the war and acquiring hotels, which ultimately became the Sheraton Hotel chain. And the anomaly being that stockholders who had paid, say, $100 a share for their stock in the 1929 boom, who held it through the period when it was practically valueless, for the years which ensued until 1945 and thereafter, might have recovered a great part of their original investment through the effective utilization by the Smith brothers and Henderson in the hotel business of the recovery which my firm and the firm of Hayes, Podell, and Shulman had effected on behalf of stockholders. The next phase of my own activities, which I'd like to describe, relates to the Army. Now, here again is a separate career, and if the publisher believes that I should could go into it in detail, I will, but I really do not believe that it represents a major element in how I finally developed as a public man, except that it was indicative of my deep feeling for the system of freedom in which World War II was the deciding factor probably in the history of the world. It was of special importance to me because it confounded the ideas and concepts which I had had for years as to the as to war. It was a war which simply had to be fought. There was just no other way. And I felt it was my war. And so very early in 1939, when the war started, I began my efforts to get into the war. I tried for the Air Force, but the then Secretary of the Army, so-and-so of Kansas, just didn't feel that he could do anything with me in the Air Force, as I was, he felt, too old at that time, being 35 years of age. I kept looking, however, and finally in the late 1940, or very early 1941, a friend of mine named Dick, that's his second name, who was then involved as a reserve officer with the Chemical Warfare Service, told me that the service, which was a small technical service in the Army, which was then kind of being refurbished and beginning to prepare for eventualities, was having great difficulty getting any kind of cooperation from suppliers or in the field of technology, and could use help as far as I was concerned. He then arranged for me to meet General Baker, who was the head of the service, at a cocktail party. I met General Baker and learned about his troubles, that is, the service's troubles, in three areas, with the making of filter paper for gas masks, with the making of magnesium for incendiary bombs, and with the business administration of the service itself, which was then making its plans for very considerable expansion. General Baker, who was looking for help everywhere, invited me to see if I could help with these matters, and indeed I found that I could. First, through the good offices of the Crown Zellerby Corporation, who were then the clients of my law firm of San Francisco, I had the paper made which he needed, a filter paper for gas masks. Secondly, I found that I had friends, namely Charlie Wilson, president of General Electric, who later became head of the War Production Board, who could be of help in the respect of the production and allocation of material which the Chemical Warfare Service needed. And as a result of these activities, General Baker invited me to become a consultant to the service, or I think it was, consultant to the service, which I then did. That caused me to go to Washington from time to time during the year 1941, and I became so involved in their activities, including, incidentally, as an element of it, meeting General Eisenhower, which was my first acquaintance with him, when the general was then chief of what's called G5, that is a strategy section of the Army. I think he was then still a colonel, but he may have been a one-star general. And he he and I took to each other immediately, and it was a friendship that lasted throughout the rest of his life as he became president, etc. In any case, General Baker invited me to come down on full-time duty with the Chemical Warfare Service. I was then engaged in the trial of a general investment case and also somewhat involved in the campaign of Fiorello LaGuardia, who was then running for re-election of mayor. So I arranged with the general to come down the day after Election Day of 1941. And indeed I did, and that was the beginning of my Army career. Pearl Harbor Day found me at the home of a girl who I was then courting, Hollis Shaw, who was a singer with Phil Spitalny's all-girl band. The telephone rang in her apartment at about 2 in the afternoon, and I was told by the service, Chemical Warfare Service, that the Japanese had attacked at Pearl Harbor, that we were at war, and that I must catch the next train back to Washington, which I did. I caught the Congressional that day, and that was the beginning of the war for me. I spent the next 9 months as chief of the control division of the Chemical Warfare Service, a position to which I was immediately appointed upon my arrival in Washington on December 7, 1941, having been up to that time the civilian aide to the chief of the service. I did, however, still continue as a civilian until March of 1942, when to remain a civilian was untenable, and I was inducted into the Army as a major in the Chemical Warfare Service. By that time, my good friend General Baker had been replaced by Major General Bill Porter as Chief of the Service. And Bill Porter turned out to be one of the most brilliant negotiators whom I have ever met in the Army or outside in all of my life. Organizing the control division, however, in the period of 9 months, caused me to, which by the way was the worldwide administrative network for the Chemical Warfare Service, starting with myself and the secretary, and ending, as far as I was concerned, in September of 1942, with over 250 officers and other assorted personnel to do the job that had to be done. In September of 1941, I apparently passed out at my desk in the Chemical Warfare Service headquarters, which was at that time at 23rd and D Street, Northwest in Washington, the present site of the State Department, and was carted off to Walter Reed, where my illness, which was probably complete exhaustion, was diagnosed as pneumonia. And I remained in Walter Reed for 6 weeks. While there, General Porter called on me and asked me what I would like to do when I was through with hospitalization. And I said that my dearest wish was to leave office duty and get some kind of field duty. He pointed out that I was too old for field duty, but that I could be a staff officer, provided that I could successfully complete the command and general staff course then being given at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. When I got out of the hospital, General Porter took me with him for a weekend to visit the commanding general at Leavenworth, General Trudeau. And after some discussion there, it was decided that I would be given an opportunity to make the grade, it being borne in mind that I had had no military experience whatever, but had come to the Army fresh from being a lawyer and immersed in business, mainly financial business. By way of preliminary indoctrination, I went to the Edgewood Arsenal, Maryland headquarters of the Chemical Warfare Service, and spent about 5 weeks deeply immersed in training films, film training, field training, and all the things which a relatively new recruit would do, a cram course second to none. I then entered at Leavenworth sometime in December 1942 for the December course, which lasted until April of 1943, and by great good fortune managed to survive the course and to graduate acceptably. This was quite a feat for me. Indeed, it was one of the toughest experiences in terms of hard-packed, unbelievable work day and night, 7 days a week, that I'd ever undertaken in my life. The practice at Leavenworth was to order those officers who had not completed the course satisfactorily off the base the night before. And this was such a traumatic experience that Leavenworth had experienced a number of suicides among officers who didn't make it. And the way in which the passing grade was achieved was by determining how many staff officers the Army needed, then drawing the line under that number and eliminating the rest. In my case, in my class, it split 80% needed, 20% not needed. Upon graduating Leavenworth, I was appointed as assistant to the Chief of Operations of the Chemical Warfare Service under a very gifted officer, General Alden Waite, Brigadier General Alden Waite, who subsequently became a Major General and the Chief of the Service. And in that capacity, I traveled with General Waite in all of the European theaters of operation and in all of the Pacific theaters of operation, engaged in planning major operations which had not yet occurred, but which would occur 6 months thereafter. We went wherever there was going to be a major operation in the ensuing 6 months. For example, I went to Europe in September of 1943 with General Waite in the convoy called Cossack, which took General Arnold and his headquarters staff over to set up headquarters in London as a preliminary to the June 1944 invasion of Europe, and with a code name Operation Overlord, our mission being to plan in connection with that operation, which was to take place some 9 months thereafter. On this same trip, I also went with General Waite for the same purpose to General Eisenhower's headquarters, which were then in Algiers, engaged in the same responsibilities. And similarly, went into the Army in Italy, then under the command of General Mark Clark, through the port of Sorrento, in order to further engage in this planning and also to inspect 4.2 mortar units of the Chemical Warfare Service then in action on the Rapido River. Two personal experiences in that respect might be worth recalling. One is that I had last seen Capri in 1927 when I made a very extensive trip through Europe as a student just before being admitted to the bar, or just after being admitted to the bar. I again saw it in 1943 from the belly of a B-25 bomber while a dogfight was going on over the Naples airport. And that was the last time up to now that I'd seen Capri. In another very tragic experience, General Waite and I went out to visit the officers' staff of a field battalion using the 4.2 mortar, also of the Chemical Warfare Service, commanded by a fine young lieutenant colonel whom we called Dolly, a nickname Dolly Stark, S-T-A-R-K. We had a fine luncheon with them and a fine visit. There was considerable firing of what they described as German 88s going on in the area, but it was a relatively quiet day. Del River. The drive back to Naples took about an hour and a half. When we got back to Naples and to our hotel room, the phone was ringing. And the message was that after we had left, a direct hit was scored on the camouflage tent in which we had had lunch, and Colonel Stark and his whole staff were killed. An unbelievable denouement, but unhappily for all mankind, not uncharacteristic of war. Paragraph. Subsequently, I engaged in the same mission in the Pacific, leaving with General Waite sometime in the summer of 1944, going through Saipan, Tinian, and Guam in the Pacific, moving into other islands of the Pacific, both for planning purposes, as I have described, and also to inspect units of the firing the 4.2 mortar, and finding my way ultimately to Bougainville, where a very prominent New Yorker was the chemical officer, Colonel Harold Riegelman, who had a marvelous war record, subsequently a Republican candidate for mayor of New York, and then going into New Guinea, General MacArthur's headquarters, and touring that whole area, doing our job, until I finally had 2 weeks as close akin to paradise as I will ever get, of rest and recreation in Australia, visiting Brisbane, Sydney, and Melbourne. And though Australia was on the most strict kind of food rationing and transportation rationing, the girls were as beautiful as ever. Sydney Harbor, with its coat hanger bridge, as glorious as anything one could imagine, and the koala bears, cuter than anything I had yet seen. That is, of course, in the animal kingdom. Returning from the Pacific in late 1944, I was again stationed for a time in Washington on the same duty, which I had had ever since getting out of Leavenworth, Leavenworth Command and General Staff School. And then in April of 1945, I was assigned to be an observer at the United Nations founding conference in San Francisco, in view of the fact that it was expected that there might be an effort to revise the Geneva Treaty, to which the United States was a party, relating to chemical and biological warfare. While there, attending the conference and the observer status, I was privy to much of the profound negotiation which went on, particularly under the auspices of the American Jewish Committee, represented by Joseph Proskauer of New York and Blank of Baltimore, which succeeded in writing into the charter the human rights protections, which have been one of its finest achievements ever since. Also, I had the opportunity of observing at work both Ed Stettinius, the U.S. Secretary of State, who died at such a young age, not too many years thereafter, and Alger Hiss, who came to such a sad and tragic end after such a brilliant beginning in a career. After V-Day, it was seen clear that my work in the Army was over, and it was generally recognized that I would soon be demobilized, as indeed I was in September of 1945. Upon being demobilized, I returned to New York, uncertain as to what I should do. But once I arrived, it became very clear to me
cases, but that what I had seen in war, in terms of the suffering and danger of others, and I had seen the trains of the wounded, the results of battle, the mowing down of whole forests of marvelous woodlands in all parts of the world by our own very 4.2 mortar, the operation of U.S. gun crews in action, the terrible tragedies, one of which I just related, of the Rapidoor River and other bloody battles, the sea of mud in which 90,000 men lived at a place, at a base called Finchhaven in New Guinea, and generally the rigors of war, that I simply could not, at my then age, which was 41, bring myself to any other life than that of trying, if I could, to make some contribution to the avoidance of war or to the establishment of the rule of law over the rule of force. I realized that considering such talents as I had, this could only come to me through political life. And so...